Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A return to normalcy in this world of derangement today? Two guests in two segments, though with a single organizing concept, tariffs. Jason Wade of the UAW will explain the union's support of Trump's auto tariffs, and Sam Gindin, an economist who is a longtime advisor to the Canadian Auto Workers Union, will explore how tariffs obscure more important issues and what Trump means for the American empire. Both these interviews were recorded on Tuesday morning, before Trump announced his array of tariffs on Wednesday. Defending them, Trump made a typically ludicrous statement. In 1913, for reasons unknown to mankind, they established the income tax so that citizens rather than foreign countries would start paying the money necessary to run our government. Then in 1929, it all came to a very abrupt end with the Great Depression, and it would never have happened had they stayed with the tariff policy. That's the end of Trump's gem. It's not easy to sort all this out, but 1. Why should foreign countries pay to run our government? 2. Foreign countries don't pay tariffs, we do. 3. Tariffs produced only modest revenues, and an income tax, aside from somewhat equalizing the distribution of income, was one of the better ways to fund a modern state. 4. The notorious Smoot-Hawley tariff was enacted in 1930, and while this is by no means settled history, you could argue that the tariff accelerated the collapse into the Great Depression. And 5, no serious person could argue that the Depression would never have happened if we'd stuck with a government funded largely by tariffs. The tariffs he announced are bonkers. There's no relationship between tariffs other countries charge in imports from the U.S. and the rates Trump is imposing on them. Some high-tariff countries like Brazil get a break, and low-tariff ones like Australia don't. To Trump, other countries' trade surpluses are signs of cheating and not reflections of manufacturing prowess or the CIA's long history of overthrowing pro-labor governments or the investment and sourcing practices of U.S. multinationals. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, one of the more cretinous members of the administration, complained that the EU won't take our beef because our beef is beautiful and theirs is weak. Who knows if any of this will stick? If the economy sinks into recession and Trump's approval rating follows it southward, he might lift the tariffs. He may also be using them as a means of dispensing favors. Pay obeisance to the king and you may get a break. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent struck a conciliatory note. One of the messages I'd like to get out tonight is everybody sit back, take a deep breath, don't immediately retaliate, and let's see where this goes, because if you retaliate, that's how we get an escalation. In other words, just take it. It's hard to imagine that happening. As I'm recording this, Canada just slapped a 25% tariff on U.S. motor vehicles. Okay, enough of me. The United Auto Workers, under the leadership of Sean Fain, looked militant and full of life when it beat the auto industry and won some good contracts back in 2023. Fain himself was talking about organizing towards a general strike. And then the other week, the UAW endorsed Trump's auto tariffs, which were announced before the broader ones he unveiled on Liberation Day. It seemed like a risky move, endorsing a dangerous economic strategy while appearing to profess fealty to Trump. I wanted to hear what the union was thinking. To enlighten us on that, we're joined by Jason Wade, a senior advisor to Sean Fain. Jason Wade. I should say from the outset, we're recording this on Tuesday, the day before what Trump calls Liberation Day, and we have no idea of what policies will emerge from that announcement. Not, of course, is ever anything very final with Trump, so even tomorrow's announcement may be preliminary information. But let's just concentrate on what we already know, and the broader political and economic questions around tariffs. So what was the UAW's position on the auto tariffs he's already announced?
I think it's good to step back and see, you know, foundationally where our organization, our union has been for the last 40 years. And it is that free trade has been a disaster for the working class in every country. It has meant economic insecurity at our facilities during bargaining. We are constantly threat with offshoring. During organizing, it is a constant, continuous barrage of threats. And when we talk to workers in Mexico or independent unions in Mexico, they experience many of the similar things, which I think kind of puts a lot of things on its head. That when they're at the bargaining table, they're being threatened with offshoring if they ask for too much. And this is a system designed by corporate America to maximize profit and to limit worker power in every country that it operates. So our position was, we are glad to see the move to start to break up this system. And we think tariffs can be part of that. Do we think it's the complete solution? Absolutely not. Do we think this is the final solution? No, we think we still have a good long way to go to getting to a point where we have a system that is fair and free for workers and that gives economic security when they go to work every day and for their communities. But we're supportive of starting to see a crack in what we've considered a 30, 40 year disaster for working people all over the world.
Okay, in the 80s, when Reagan slapped quotas on Japanese car imports, the Japanese firms responded by building plants in the non-union South. Will things be different this time?
They built plants in Ohio and Indiana as well. Look, do we hope they're building plants in the North where the laws are better for workers? Do we actually want better laws across the board for all workers? This is only one, we maintain our criticisms of both parties and of this party around workers' rights and on those issues going forward. But we don't see the point, the assault on workers' rights is going to happen regardless. And Trump is going to do this, on tariffs regardless. And we're able to say, we've long held a position that we need to break up the free trade system is kind of two separate discussions. We will fight for the best right for workers wherever those plants are, and we will fight to organize them and give those workers voice on the job.
Now, what we call free trade has been, many things have happened under that label. One of the things that has happened has been the integration of auto production in North America across the three countries, the three NAFTA countries, or whatever Trump changed his name to. Now, this could be very disruptive to that model. Do you have any concerns about what that might do to the industry?
Well, it's interesting that you say it is integrated because each one of these companies have their own global platforms, like a plant and you can see notes on how companies talk about it. A plant in Mexico is the same in Germany, is the same in the U.S. if they're making the same platform. So the argument around automation on line speed, maybe there's a little bit higher line speed in Mexico because they don't have work standard rules. But everything is by and large the same. The managers are probably paid the same in all the facilities. The only thing that isn't standardized across NAFTA or North America is workers' wages. What we're saying is this: if it's going to be integrated, we want to integrate it in the right way that is pro-worker power. And what do we mean by that? Like if you look at the Fort Wayne facility that makes the Sierra and Silverado, those workers make around $37 an hour, have excellent health care. They have a 401k. If you're tier one, you have a pension. And they sell a truck that is exactly, the trim level, everything is exactly the same as workers in Silao, Mexico. There's also two other plants in Flint, Michigan, and Oshawa, Canada, that also make Sierras and Silverados. But those two plants are actually mirror plants. And they're really the only difference. And talking to folks that have been in those plants, other than the language being spoken, the only difference between the two plants is the wages. GM doesn't give a discount to consumers when they buy a truck made out of Silao. They don't say, these workers only make $3.50. We're going to give a discount to the consumer. All that money goes to Wall Street. So the way that GM is doing enormous compensation for its executives, the way it's doing enormous stock buybacks is because of these unbalanced trade agreements. And look, we're a union that has a longstanding principle of same work, same pay. And that's born out of whether you're black or white, man or woman. And for the life of me, I can't figure out an argument why a river, an arbitrary river, would be a justifiable argument for workers to make one-tenth of workers in Fort Wayne. And if we step back and think about that, because if Mexico was making those trucks for Mexican consumption, maybe there would be a different argument. 80%, 85% of those vehicles are headed to the U.S. market. So we've already established, and we don't think it's enough, but we've already established how much value labor should be paid for producing that wealth. And the company said, no, we have a different idea. And they've for decades worked with charro unions in Mexico with the government and kept those wages down. Silao now has an independent union and has seen substantial wage growth in the years since they've won their independent union. But that being said, 10% year over year on $1.85 as your starting point, it's going to be generations. I'll be long since retired that those workers would actually close the wage gap. So yes, it's highly integrated, but we don't think it's integrated in the right way. And that's what we're fighting to fix. We've long been against free trade, and we're a little bit perplexed with a lot of people's consternation of defending a system that is built by corporations towards environmental degradation and worker oppression. So yes, we think we need to break it up in a way that makes sense, or fully integrate it in a way that makes sense.
Well, this is funny you should mention environmental degradation. This is an industry that is responsible for a lot of it.
Yeah. And you look at what happened in batteries in 2010, lead batteries. EPA raised standards, and the entire industry moved to Mexico and just destroyed communities. And that shouldn't happen. I don't want that for Mexican workers.
Speaking of Mexican workers, has the UAW consulted with its counterparts in Mexico and Canada? As far as I know, Unifor is very annoyed. So what about the relations with workers and unions across the borders?
We've had dialogues with independent unions in all three countries. We've been very clear of where we want to go, and we have obviously different opinions on approaches, but what we want to see is managed free trade on the backside of this. We want to see quotas that say there's some relationship between the amount of vehicles you sell and the amount of vehicles you produce in a country, kind of like the U.S.-Canada Auto Pact from 1965. There's some relationship to the supply chain also engaged in that. But then also that we want a high road trade agreement. We want more labor rights in all three countries. We want a North American minimum wage in auto, but also for all durable goods. The things that are happening in auto and auto parts is happening in aerospace, ag, imp across the board. And again, those products are being taken from Mexico and sold primarily in the U.S., and they're not enjoying the fruits of their labor in a way that we know the companies can afford, because we have pushed them to afford it. And I step back for a sec. I think about my grandmother worked at Dodge Maine, who did trim, and she retired in 1975. And she made at that time around $6, $7 an hour. Good union wage. My grandfather was disabled, was able to raise her two sons, my dad and my uncle, and provide a relatively stable middle-class lifestyle at that wage at that time. That's in $1975. Today, trim workers in Mexico, in today's dollars, make $1.50. They're not afforded the same standard that my grandmother was afforded 50 years ago. And that is gross. And it shouldn't be defended, and it should be dismantled and fixed.
Well, I think a lot of people would agree with you, but aren't quite convinced that tariffs are the way to go about it. But what about the impact of raising prices by a few thousand dollars a unit?
I guess that may be stepping back. Then, like, this is not the design of... If we had our way, this would not have been the design of how we would approach this, right? We pushed on the Democrats for years, but we think the Democrats from the 19, you know, when NAFTA passed, half the party was against NAFTA. That is, it's not, I don't think anyone could say with a straight face that half the party is anti these free trade deals at this point.
I don't think you could fit them in a cloakroom, could you?
Yeah. So this is not by our design. Like, this is the opportunity we have, and we've been firmly against free trade and wanting fair trade and managed fair trade for generations, and something that actually lifts up all boats. And this is where we're at, and we think there's an opportunity here. And what I'm perplexed by is there's not more voices saying, okay, we're going to move from this position into a new position. We have to break the old consensus of corporate Democrats and Republicans on these lousy trade deals that hurt all workers. And we're not hearing that voice at all. You know, you hear DeLuzio, and that was a good piece in New York Times, but I'm hearing really a lot of, this is new taxes, this is new, really seeming to defend the status quo. And it's perplexing to me. I'm of an age that, you know, I remember NAFTA was passed when WTO was created. And these were all seen as antithetical to a workers' rights agenda. And now it seems like a lot of folks are openly defending that system and take umbrage with maybe how we're approaching it. But the lack of voice on, no, this is what trade should look like, is really kind of shocking at this point. We're trying to lay out a vision that's, we actively talk about raising the floor. We're fully supportive of environmental standards being raised. we want to make sure our communities are safe. Like, workers should not have anxiety every time they go to work. I've lived through plant closures. This is devastating to your people's families, their communities. It just tears them apart. These are real things that we should be grappling with. And it seems like it's often synthesized down to, well, this is a tax. It's going to cost more. And to me, I'm like, so what I'm hearing is, if we stop paying workers $3 an hour and start paying them $37, that's wrong. That's the cost. That's the inflation. And I'm just, that I don't understand that worldview. Like the defense is, and also it gives companies a pass. They are making obscene profits right now. They've made obscene profits for decades. And the conversation should be, well, maybe price gouging should stop. We should make stock buybacks illegal. And they should eat a lot of this cost. And actually putting money in Mexican workers' pockets would grow that economy, would grow the entire North American economy. But that's not the conversation we're hearing. We're hearing fear-mongering about not losing that discount that it seems like a lot of folks have really baked into their assumptions of how the economy should work. Well, I hope you're ready to pay more for this, or I hope you're ready to pay more for that. Why? Because workers might act. One, you're assuming workers are not getting paid a fair wage right now. If they did, that would be passed on to consumers, and that it's okay that there's price gouging going on by companies. That's what I'm hearing when I hear those kind of questions.
I'm speaking with Jason Wade, an advisor to the president of the UAW. The political impact of raising prices by a few $1,000s a unit could be severe. I mean, will that be good for demand and for the popular image of the UAW and unions generally?
When average transaction prices exploded 30% after the 2019 agreement, through no real increase in inputs, our wages only went up 6%. Where was Wall Street screaming then when there was price gouging going on?
Well, I'm not talking about Wall Street. I'm talking about the broad American public. We're going to see prices of things go way up.
We were the ones that brought it up. We highlighted it during our stand-up strike. And we were like, they're gouging people. There's money here in the system. There's money in this system. We do not have a scarcity problem. We have a distribution problem. This system is not – this is an indefendable system. And we need to get to the point where we're actually having discussions about how to build a trading system – and a political economy that works for workers. And if that requires us to work on breaking it apart, that's where we're at. And again, we would really have enjoyed a pathway with Democrats, and it wasn't for lack of asking, that we could have had a much more rational and balanced approach. But this is where we're at. We want to see a trading system that has standards baked into it and social standards baked into it and things that make sense and make it work for working people, but this is where we're at.
Does the union have a position on other tariffs? For example, metals tariffs would be really hard in auto producers. Do you have any thoughts on those?
You know, we came out against the IEEPA tariffs for sure. We thought, you know, if we're going to see the potential for economic disruption in the system, we want it to be towards the benefit of the workers in that system. And we didn't think the IEEPA migration and fentanyl tariffs met that standard. The metal ones, you know, there is excess capacity out there. We don't have as much exposure. We do have some electric steel and some auto steel facilities, but I would, you know, in large regard, defer to the steel workers on that issue and what they think, you know, would serve their members and those workers the best.
Okay, and finally, a lot of people, even some very union-sympathetic people, are reading this as a gesture of support for Trump, who is a profoundly anti-labor guy. So what do you say to them?
No, we've been abundantly clear that, you know, and very vocal on a whole variety of issues that we take umbrage with the Trump administration over and, you know, in our higher ed workplaces, we're seeing cuts, we're seeing people expelled, we're seeing detentions, NIH, we're seeing cuts, you know, college campuses, we're seeing cuts from National Institute of Health and Science. So we're taking issues with that, what's happening at the board. We've been very vocal that, look, we bargain with folks all the time that we don't agree with. When we sit down with a company, you know, even if we have some decent relationships at the bargaining table, we have very different goals in what we're trying to do. And sure, you want it to be agreeable in some regards and working on getting a deal, but, you know, we're often at loggerheads. And with companies that probably most of them are a lot of CEOs actually agree with a lot of what Trump's saying. And we go in and we try to win the best we can for our members and for the working class. That's what we did in 2023. There was a lot of things being said and things we didn't agree with that were being said in the media by the autos, but we still went in and got the deal we could. And that, you know, and just kind of unraveling that a little bit, what happened on the backside of that was that our companies used our trade laws to try to back out of the deal. Stellantis used NAFTA or USMCA or whatever we call it this week to try to back out of the deal because they could. They said they wanted to look, this is Carlos Tavares's words, they wanted to operate more like a Chinese company and drive all their costs to low-cost countries. And they were moving from a 62-63% domestic manufactured company into the 40s because they saw it as an opportunity to do that. And we just think that's fundamentally not right, unfair to workers, and we need to have a rational system that as we produce things in this country that workers have an opportunity to enjoy that wealth.
I think we can agree that we're not likely to get to that rational, more humane system under Donald Trump.
But we may have an opportunity to break the free trade consensus. And unless we break that and we take the opportunities that there are clearly divisions between corporate America and Wall Street and you know, their elected leader right now. And that those divisions are breaking apart a system that there's been 40 or 50 years of consensus on. And yes, we should break it. And yes, we should have tough conversations of what that should look like on the backside. But because we don't like the way it's being broken, we shouldn't do anything. It's just because, I mean, do we really think that another Democratic administration would be breaking apart the system? The folks that brought us a TPP?
No, it seems very unlikely.
Did IPEF seem like the lead up to breaking apart the free trade system? We have an opportunity to start to dismantle the system and then have workers' voices involved. And we encourage everyone to get involved in that conversation of what it should look like. You know, maybe it's a generational thing. You know, I spent a good part of my youth like trying to, you know, as a late trade unionist fighting against free trade. And it's just, to hear a lot of folks associated with labor who are seemingly defending the system. It's disheartening. This system didn't just happen. This system is a collusion between the ruling classes in other countries against workers in those countries. And it happened through a long process leading up into the 80s and 90s where these free trade agreements were born. And this, if given the opportunity, we should try to break these down and, you know, allow for a much better system to take root.
That was Jason Wade, an advisor to the United Auto Workers President Sean Fain. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Domenico Scarlatti's Sonata in C Minor, number 302 in Kirkpatrick's catalog. And for another view, here's Sam Gindin. Sam is an economist who spent the last quarter of the 20th century as an advisor to the Canadian Auto Workers Union, which in 2013 merged with another union to form something called Unifor. He's been writing, teaching, and consulting since. Apologies to the old-style phone audio. Sam Gindin. I want to talk more broadly about the Trump regime in a bit, but first, what do you make of the auto tariffs and the UAW's support for them?
A few things. One is that the whole tariff thing has really diverted attention from what the problem for workers really is. I mean, workers, you know, if you really wanted to address as a union, I'm saying, you know, what the problems are for working people in America, you'd be talking about inequality, you'd be talking about union rights, you'd be talking about universal health care, affordable housing, infrastructure and, of course, the environment, and also about what's an actual strategy for the environment, which would mean trying to fix everything in the world. It's not just kind of from here on in. It's fixing everything that's been happening to the environment. So one of the problems of the tariff thing is just not seeing it in that kind of context and just talking about tariffs. That's one problem. The other problem is there's a history here, which I'm surprised that people aren't thinking about more. And the history is that in the mid-80s, Reagan introduced actually quotas, not tariffs, but quotas, which are tougher, on the Japanese to force them to come here. And this was very much cheered as, well, this should help workers. And the problem is you always have to put tariffs in a larger perspective. And what happened in the mid-80s with tariffs, with the quotas, was they did come to the United States. There were more jobs in the United States, but they came to the American South. They had all the states bid for who's going to get them, so they got the subsidies. They had modern plants. They had no legacy costs for retirees, and they were very competitive. So it actually put more pressure on workers in the North. They weren't getting the jobs. They were actually losing more jobs to the South. And then the Japanese began to make the standards, set the standards for the industry. That policy in itself, the tariff thing, didn't work for working people. I mean, since then, the industry continued to collapse. That's a problem. The other problem is that even if you're just looking at the auto industry itself, the big question in the auto industry is the transition to electric vehicles. That's the big question. And tariffs won't do that. In fact, all tariffs are going to do is keep out Chinese-made electrical vehicles. Just as an example, in the late 50s, the U.S. probably made about 3/4 of the vehicles in the world. Right now, China is probably making about 3/4 of the electric vehicles in the world. So if you're really thinking about where this is going, whether it's auto is really going to be the kind of historical job setter that it was in the past, or whether this is a transition to electric vehicles, the tariffs aren't the solution. That's a big problem in terms of how this is all being framed and what it'll actually mean to for auto workers.
I just interviewed a guy from the UAW, Jason Wade, who's an advisor to the president. And he was making the argument that the tariffs are a good start on busting up the free trade system, and that's why they support them. But free trade has been so damaging to workers in general and auto workers in particular that busting it up in any way is really a high priority, and this is a start. What do you say to that?
Well, you can understand why auto workers are struggling with what to do. The auto industry has lost tons of jobs, although, you know, as I said earlier, there's also jobs that came here, but they're non-union. And free trade isn't something that we should make into an abstract principle that we support. You know, one of the ironies is that in Canada, we fought against free trade in the mid-80s, almost won that battle, and now the Canadians are arguing free trade. They don't want any tariffs. I mean, that's a big paradox. It's not as if Canadian workers are taking a more progressive position. They're just trying to defend themselves, and the Americans are defending. I think that the trap is that you start making the tariffs into an answer. So it's a simple answer. You can mobilize around it. It'll be popular, and it diverts the attention from the larger problems that are going on, that have been going on since the early 80s. I mean, it's what neoliberalism was about. So I think it's a diversion. It's a misdirection is one problem. And the other thing is whether it will really work unless you're doing other things. I mean, if it's just a repeat of what happened with the Japanese thing, it's not going to work. And if it ignores the electric vehicle problem, it's about the American companies not being able to keep up with the Chinese now, who started from almost zero, but also the role of the Canadian state. So it's just not getting at the big problems. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the fact that workers are in trouble. The problem is that if you try to fix this in a simple, easy way, you're not helping workers. You're missing the point. So, you know, I don't blame workers for feeling this way, but it's just a larger question. And, of course, it's a larger question inside the labor movement. If auto workers are just going to be thinking about themselves and not what the impact is going to be on others in terms of car prices, auto just being special that way, it creates a larger problem because you can't actually build class solidarity to take on the state, which is the biggest problem.
Well, it's funny because the UAW has a lot of members who work in the service industries who are going to be harmed by this. They'll get no gain and they'll just see their prices go up. It's not even fully serving their own membership.
That's true. I mean, even people in the auto plants, you know, they're not going to be protected if a plant goes into the South and then they source it from the South. You know, it's not clear that it's going to help auto workers, but it'll certainly affect them. They buy cars too. There is this moment of actually people wanting to talk about there's a problem and how do we get at it. And because of the absence of a left, taking this on. It's been left to Trump to articulate, and people should be worried about whether they're on a track here that is actually addressing the most important issues for their own members, auto workers, but, you know, the whole union, of course, but for working people generally. That's the problem. It reflects the defeat of labor and the defeat of the left that we're left with just fighting on tariffs or no tariffs and not looking at all the other larger issues.
Tariffs generally and economic development. For Trump, they just seem like the kind of simple grand gesture of the sort that he loves. The king orders tariffs, and here they come. But with no industrial policy of any kind, is this strategy likely to produce much in the way of results?
No. You can see this going on in the States is that this isn't a policy that's coming from capital. This is a policy. They don't see it as national development. They don't see it as helping them develop. This is Trump trying to say, we're the most powerful country in the world. This is the mega thing. We're the most powerful country in the world. How come we're paying more of the burden and we're getting less of the benefits? And I'm going to turn this around by messing with tariffs. But he's not thinking in terms of what you just raised, you know, industrial policy and redistribution of income, actually challenging corporate rights, just changing the balance of power in the United States. And without that, it'll work in some marginal ways, but with a lot of negatives. For example, you know, Canada is very vulnerable because we're doing the same things that the Americans are doing, basically, in terms of, you know, auto and parts, at roughly the same wages. And if the companies, American companies or whoever's investing here, begin to get nervous about this, yeah, they may just decide, we don't know where the hell this is going. Even if Trump drops the tariffs, maybe they'll come back another time. Maybe it makes sense for us to go into the United States just in case. So some of that might happen. On the other hand, you're going to get the uncertainty is going to affect investment. The inflation is going to lead to higher interest rates and maybe a recession. So, yeah, this isn't a strategy that can work. This is Trump's attempt to rejig the American empire so it doesn't actually challenge the American empire except it wants it to work more to the benefit of Americans. And I think the problem they're going to have is, even just in economic terms, if people actually came to the United States, the dollar would rise. And if the dollar rose, America would be less competitive. So it's driving them to go further. They put tariffs on China, so then Vietnam and Malaysia and South Korea and Indonesia start shipping the same things because Walmart and Amazon aren't going to say, well, we've got a tariff on Chinese goods now, so we're going to source it all in the United States. They're going to find other cheap places. So then Trump is going to respond with broadening the tariffs. And then you have to start thinking about capital controls because you've got to control the dollar, and then you have to have capital controls. You actually need cooperation. And meanwhile, Trump is not just attacking countries he doesn't like, he's attacking American allies.
Well, I got to say, making an enemy of Canada is just a really remarkable political accomplishment.
Canada's strongest position is obviously you have to retaliate whether it makes sense or not. It's not the turf you want to fight the Americans on about retaliating against each other, but you have to do it. But the real strength of Canada is actually to say what you just said. I mean, the notion that Canada is suddenly having to have discussions on how do we delink ourselves from the United States, because even if there are no tariffs, what it's exposed is how dependent we are in the United States. Do we want to be like the United States, which raises questions about what kind of values we have, what kind of society do we want? And if Canada is starting to think about that, about delinking and diversifying and more inward development and more planning, because we'd have to do that. If we delink from the United States in any degree, I mean, this would take time, but in any degree, you'd have to think about how you restructure your economy and where you're going to get demand from. And it's raising those kinds of questions. And if that's the case for Canada, other countries can't help but watch this and say, if Canada's made into an enemy of the United States and can't abide by all this stuff, what does it mean for us?
Nobody's safe.
And by the way, what you started to just say about development, I think, is an important point, because there's a role for tariffs. Obviously, in developed countries, free trade is a limited solution. Sometimes you can be one of the winners. But so it's not an argument against tariffs. It's not an argument that free trade is good. It's an argument about really understanding tariffs as proposed by Trump as not just erratic and not just probably a strategy that won't work. But I suspect that what it's really about is, if you see it as rejigging the benefits and burdens of the American empire, the tariffs are just a ploy to get something else. For example, you know, if it is going back to something like the Plaza Accord, where the value of the American dollar was going to be lower than the Japanese yen was going to go up, if you're trying to do that, it requires cooperation. And if you're doing this with one country like Japan, you can threaten them. But if you're really trying to rejig the whole global economy, it's just going to be a very hard thing to pull off. That's a pretty complicated thing. But, you know, right now it seems that I'm trying to figure out where is Trump going? Because had he just in a very modest way said, we're not getting enough benefits and we want to modify it, though you can imagine America doing that and pulling it off. But going through all of this, he's risking losing his base once he gets inflation and the economy isn't good. He's risking his relationship with capital because they all thought he was not serious about this and now they're freaking. He's exposing himself by having somebody like Musk run around and then say, oh, the tariffs are going to give us all this revenue. And then him saying, yeah, of course, we want to give that as a tax cut to all these rich guys. I mean, his base is going to see this. Trump is scary, and people should be nervous about where he's going, but they should also be seeing that there are contradictions here that are going to happen. And then the question is, then what?
I want to return to this in a moment, but first, it seems like the UAW didn't consult with Unifor. Is there any kind of cross-border solidarity going on between the unions?
No. The problem is, and I don't just blame the UAW for this. I mean, this is a two-way thing. Like in bargaining, they just finished a round of bargaining last September, and they didn't cooperate. And I don't think that was just a UAW problem. I think that the Canadian auto workers were, you know, at that moment kind of playing it safe. Let's see what the Americans do. If they do something great, we'll go for the same. If they flop, we'll blame them. I don't think that this is just an American auto workers problem. There should be cooperation. I don't believe that international bargaining is the answer. I think the problems that we're facing are larger, and they're about confronting our state. They're political problems. And in order to confront the state, you actually have to be building class solidarity within your country. The problem is how fragmented the labor movement is in both countries, the relationship public and private, and competition over organizing between unions. You know, the whole Amazon thing should have been a labor movement project, a crusade of the labor movement, not a question of seeing if the Teamsters could do it. So the problem of solidarity is really important. It's not just an international thing. It's within each country. And bargaining isn't a solution because all that's happened with bargaining is that unions went from business unionism nationally to trying to extend it internationally. These are big issues. We're seeing the impact of decades of defeat. And the defeat wasn't just losing things or two-tier. It was a whole sense of fragmented the class, but a whole sense of it moved away from legitimating capitalism, which was what was going on after the war, to Thatcher's thing about fatalism. Just tell people there is no alternative and break them, and then it's cheaper. And, you know, at first they were nervous, but they found out that labor was a paper tiger. So we're just seeing the impact of all that defeat and the lack of a strategy to respond and grasping at straws. I suspect in the States, it's also feigned. I can't say this. I don't have any reason to know this. Being nervous about his base, that if Trump positions himself that I'm the one who's defending workers because I'm doing tariffs, nobody else is doing anything, and what is your leader doing in terms of getting you jobs? And that's a real problem for unions because unions can say, well, we're fighting and bargaining for better wages or conditions. But, you know, the nature of unions isn't there about getting you jobs and getting you job security unless it's a larger class struggle.
I'm speaking with the economist Sam Gindin. Just one more Canadian question before we get back to Trump. I saw a clip of a press conference that Mark Carney was giving, and I have to say I was impressed by what the sophistication of what he was saying about responding to the tariff problem and breaking up with the U.S. that he's talking about. A serious industrial policy, backward integration, using phrases one doesn't expect to hear at a press conference. What do you make of him and that strategy? Is he serious?
I just happened by coincidence to get a call from a researcher in one union who said exactly what you just said. I just watched Carney's speech and I wanted to go out and campaign for him.
You know,
this is a strong left person. This isn't just, you know, a bureaucrat or something. And, you know, my response to it would be that I think he's saying the right things. I think he's actually recognizing that if this is serious, it doesn't just mean we say, oh, tit for tat, we'll put up tariffs too. If this is serious, then there has to be major diversification of trade and a major reorientation of how we produce and everything. You can't do that without massive government involvement. So I think he's speaking to that, you know, and I think he has to politically. I mean, the reaction in Canada to to this threat from the States is serious. So I think it's good politically, but I think it's also the right thing to say. And of course, that should be supported. What makes me skeptical is that this isn't coming from an organized left that is pushing him. And I'm more worried that he's, I think, doing the only thing you could do in terms of bargaining with Trump, which is not to give up, just make it clear that you're ready to take this on. But I think in the hope that this will end up with Trump backing off, American capital rebelling, and going back to normal. And I guess that's what I would be worried about, that this is good, both populist and economic line, and then we shouldn't just write that off. But there's no base. Canadian business's biggest fear in life is that they'll be cut off from the United States. And it's like bargaining. The only way you can actually deal with this right now is to stand up to it and hope it goes away. And there's good reason to think that this can't last. I mean, policy doesn't make sense. It's hard for anybody to figure out a real rationale for it. And American capital is going to, as soon as they see some cracks, they're afraid, of course, to get a reaction from Trump if General Motors takes them on or something. But, they'll be whispering. And if there are cracks, we're just going to see it. Structural power of capital without even getting together as a conspiracy. If you see investment not happening because of uncertainty, if you see the supply chains being disrupted, if you see the economy getting into trouble, there will be a reaction. So I think it has to be understood that this isn't the beginning of a nationalist break with the United States. But it does create space, and it should be welcome for creating the space. The problem is who's taking advantage of that space.
Okay, now back to Trump. How do you see his tariffs in the context of an overall strategy insofar as there is one?
America has power, and like the quotas on the Japanese before, that power could be used with selective temporary tariffs that send a message that there are rules that are about free trade, but America is number one. And because we're number one, we need some flexibility in running this in terms of reproducing ourselves. And you're not going to kick the shit out of our auto industry. So I could imagine America throwing its weight around. I don't see America as on the verge of economic collapse or anything. So it would have been possible to use tariffs to start rejigging things. But this particular way of doing it and alienating your allies along the way in a fairly chaotic way, he's obviously convinced of this by the economists he have around him or just his instincts for tariff protection, which go way back. But the only way to find a rationale on it, I don't mean that it's there, is to see it as a bargaining ploy with the rest of the empire that is basically inviting them to say, what do we have to do to get back to normal? Just, for example, with China. Where's this going with China? And I don't know, but I wouldn't be shocked if Trump said something like, you have to open up your markets to high tech and financial services without all the strings you've got you attach to it normally. And China would say, we'll do some of that. And he would, and maybe they'll even give them Taiwan and say, we're not going to fight you on Taiwan. And you would end up with a more liberal global order. There'd be more free trade, and Trump would say that was my game plan all along, and I did it. I don't see that as impossible, because there's got to be an exit strategy here. And the only exit strategy I see, because to really challenge globalization, he has to challenge capital, and without a base that wants to challenge capital. This is the contradiction for the right everywhere. They're mobilizing resentment against what globalization has meant to them, which is linked to neoliberalism, but they're not ready to go far enough. I think only socialists could go far enough to say we need an alternative, because the alternative has to be radical if you're going to break out of globalization. You're just dismantling all kinds of economic relationships. So the question is that his game plan? Is the next step to create a lower dollar, which can also be problematic, more inflation, maybe it gets out of hand, but it would be a coordinated one. Is this what he's trying to do, is get everyone together and say, look, guys, you have to respect us more, and this is what it's going to cost, and then you can go back to normal? I don't know what else his strategy could be, because I don't see him disrupting the whole global economy without a base for doing that or capital pushing that. And if he does that, that just raises a lot of other questions. I mean, it would be a very hard thing to pull off. And the other danger, I think, which, we don't talk about, is the end result may be what the Democrats are doing. They're going to sit around, hope he stumbles, falls on his face. Then they come in and they restore the old status quo that everybody hated. but now we'll be relieved to get, and you end up with lower expectations, labor movement weaker and being relieved, and the Democrats see themselves as back in the saddle. I mean, that's another option here. But we're really living through one of these moments that is, you know, historically going to be very important to see where it goes. It could consolidate the global order, or it can actually open up some real major cracks. The tragedy is that all these things are always contingent on the balance of class forces, and the left just isn't there. And that's what makes it so dangerous.
It's hard to imagine Trump challenging the capitalist order, though he seems like the last person to do that.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, even when he sounds like it, it is not what he's going to do. And he couldn't carry it off anyways because of everything it would imply. Even a fairly left government would have trouble pulling this off. You know, I guess one of the things I'd say just generally, I think we're really living through a moment and have been for a while now of a polarization of options. Social democracy has collapsed everywhere because there isn't actually a middle of the road solution that can work. And the right mobilizes all the resentment and all the wedge issues, but none of that is a strategy. I mean, you can't get rid of immigrants and think that that's going to create jobs in the Middle West. There's no strategy there. And so it's a polarization of options. You know, either things go to the right, and even then, if they're not ready to take on capital, I don't know that there's going to be a solution. It'll just kind of be stumbling on. Or they have to go to the left, and the left isn't in a position to do that. I think in the case of America, I think expectations have been lowered because of the fear of fascism and authoritarianism, which is obviously is there. But, you know, how far this will go, that people are lowering their expectations just to protect themselves against where Trump might go. And that isn't going to solve the problem either. And that's the problem. Biden couldn't solve this problem, even with certain gestures. It really is a polarization of options, which needs, for the left, it means we have to think more radically rather than maybe we should get, you know, get a social democratic victory. It just failed everywhere.
Business and finance have been rather quiet. You think they'd be displeased by the tariffs and the general nationalist turn of Trump's policies. Are they biding their time? Are they afraid? How do you make of that quiet?
Capital was looking at Trump and saying, we're going to get all these goodies from him. He's going to lower taxes for us. He's going to give us deregulation. He won't advance anything on labor rights. He won't do anything disruptive on the environment. So I think they were saying, we're going to get all of this stuff. And then this other stuff is just rhetoric. I just don't think they believe that there'll be some marginal things, a selective tariff here and there, like electric vehicles. But I don't think any of them were thinking this would happen. Then you've got a guy who does have some autonomy. There is an autonomy that the President of the United States has to do things. And so at first, I think they're just nervous about being isolated. You know, in the high-tech sector, they really thought that they could make him their man. But, you know, what they're going to discover over time is that this is actually scary for them. It's dangerous for them. It's risky for them. It could lead to a backlash that could hurt them. But at first, you know, capital isn't organized that way. You know, capital is usually looking for the state to represent them and organize capital where there are differences within capital. So they're kind of watching. They're afraid to jump in. But, you know, as cracks happen, and the cracks aren't going to be immediate, like even people who are think he doesn't spend enough time on the economy and et cetera. But when people start feeling the impact of the cuts and the program cuts and ending up with a new bureaucracy at the state level instead of ending bureaucracy and all the dysfunctionality, when they start rebelling and it's a fresh popularly, I think business will feel more confident in challenging it. And just what business does every day, I think, will have an impact. So I think the fact that they're quiet is, you've got Trump, he's popular until he's less popular. They want to be careful about what he might do next, or to them in particular. So, yeah, I would expect that we will see them reacting. And I guess the midterms will be important, you know, the read coming out of the midterms. And then the other question is whether Trump, he's a survivor and he's crafty, and whether he reads the writing on the wall and says, I got to make this into, this was my game plan, and you know, I'm going to do retreats, which I'll describe as part of my game plan. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, one of the things that's been happening with Trump, and I got this from talking to people on the GM strike, the UAW strike, is I asked them what their interactions were with workers that were Trumpists. And they said they were having arguments with them about whether Trump would really deliver jobs in the Midwest. And they were winning the argument. But the people they were arguing with said, but at least Trump is trying. at least the guy is doing something, and I haven't seen that from any other quarter. And now the question is going to be, Trump's actually in office. He's going to be responsible for what happens. And if he doesn't deliver, I think it's the response from the base that'll be very important, and then we'll see business getting active and responding, because I don't think they are going to just sit on the sidelines for this. But it is a really unique position. I mean, a right-wing guy is actually not doing what Capitol actually would like to see happen.
Yeah, it does make you have to rethink the relation between Capitol and the state.
Yeah, you know, well, it's two things, you know. I mean, there was always this, there was this debate that didn't emerge in Marxism until the 70s, where it wasn't just Capitol calls up and tells them what to do. It was that there is a degree of autonomy in the state. But I think we also have to think of the state in much more complicated ways. It isn't just Trump comes in and he chops off the head of a couple of agencies and then everything is changed. The state is still there. It's still an institution with a culture and with people in it who are looking at this, and they might be liberal capitalists in their ideology. Once things start turning, I think we'll see leaks coming from the state. I don't think Trump himself is transforming the state. You know, I mean, he's transforming parts of it. And strategy was obviously shock and awe to neutralize the state from being an oppositional force in any way. But you're right. I mean, there has to be the more nuanced, complicated discussion of the state. But I wouldn't project anything, you know, in terms of saying he now controls everything. He's going to have contradictions, including from within the state, I think. But, yeah, this is the kind of thing we have to really think about and understand, because these are the critical questions.
I'm Sam Gindin, an economist who served for 25 years as an advisor to what was then known as the Canadian Auto Workers Union. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'm finding Baroque harpsichord music to be an extremely powerful antidote to the derangements of our moment. Let's go out with this, some of François Couperin's Les Fausses de la Grande Ministrandice, performed by Olivier Beaumont. Till next week, bye.